morning, Mr. Mayor, council members, residents of Palm Beach Island. Today we're here to discuss financial frauds. And obviously, it's lately in the media, and however, it's been in existence for hundreds of years that Mr. Harper will discuss, and it's something that is ongoing that we all have to protect ourselves with and be able to identify them and also be able to try to remedy them if we find ourselves in them. So that's what we're here to discuss with you today. Now, with me is Jack Stein, senior partner at our firm, also my father, who started off as the assistant state attorney for the New York State from 1967 to 1972, then worked at the SEC as special counsel from 1972 to 1980. After that, he's been in private practice for the last 29 years, primarily representing and bringing claims against brokerage firms. But also in that capacity, he has been appointed as a receiver by both the state of Florida and the SEC numerous times. Behind me is Charles Harper. Mr. Harper started off with the SEC as a law clerk and worked his way up to run the whole Miami office for a period of 15 years. He was responsible for approximately 60 lawyers and more than a staff of 100, including securities investigators. After leaving the SEC in 1995, he went to go work for a large wirehouse, where he was assistant general counsel and vice president in charge of regulatory investigations and internal investigations of the own brokers in the firm. After that, he's been currently for the past 7 years an expert witness, actually testifying and being retained both by the government and independent parties on financial frauds. Now, the question that we have to start is, why does this island, the residents of this island, have to be concerned about it, frankly, more than other individuals? And the issue is, while many people on this island are very discreet about their wealth, it's not what they discuss. Unfortunately, it's about what the media discuss. I'm sorry, it's a little light up there, but it says, why are you a target? How affluent are the residents of Palm Beach? This is a quote from the media kit in the Palm Beach Daily News. The average Palm Beach Daily News reader has an estimated household investment portfolio of approximately $31 million. So while the residents of the island may be discreet in their discussions of their wealth, unfortunately, the media and businesses aren't. Now, while that brings to the island many benefits, including many banks and brokerage firms and high-end retail, unfortunately, it also brings another element. It brings an element to the island of people who work within the brokerage system and outside of the brokerage system, not to earn money, but to take money. And that's what we'll be discussing today in two parts. The first part, which will be Mr. Harper discussing Ponzi schemes and overreaching financial frauds. The second part is what happens in individual brokerage account and banks. Then Mr. Stein will be discussing affinity issues, and then we will have closing remarks on how to protect yourself. Mr. Harper.
Thank you very much. Mr. Mayor, council members, Craig worked for the state of Florida for 3 years prosecuting securities frauds when he got out of law school, and for the last 12 years he's been very successful in private practice representing both claimants and brokerage firms in securities litigation. Well, let me talk to you a little bit about Ponzi schemes. I just got hired last week to work with a man that sold a very valuable piece of property in the islands to a Ponzi scheme. And this Ponzi scheme paid investors 9% or up to 15% a month. That's a month, okay? So it's like, you know, as much as 120% a year. And he sold his property to it, and so now it's embroiled in this big SEC investigation. And so I'm going to tell you about Ponzi schemes, and that way you'll know what it's all about. I got a court transcript of a hearing that was just held in that case, and the defense lawyer is there, and the SEC mentioned something about Ponzi schemes. The defense lawyer gets up, and the court says to the defense lawyer, well, who's this Ponzi guy anyway? And the defense lawyer says, I think he was back in Chicago. And the court says, he was from Chicago? And the court goes, yes, I think he had barrels of IOUs and receipts. I looked that up once when I started to practice. And the court interrupts him and says, I did too one time. I know it's like a person. It's like the Miranda of securities. And, of course, Miranda is that warning that the police give you. And so this really isn't the Miranda of securities. This is a fraudster that came to the United States as an immigrant and got caught Boston shortchanging people on restaurant tabs, went to Canada, got involved in another scheme, came back to Boston, and started something that told people that he was going to make enormous amounts of money on postal reply receipts on foreign postage. They had, like, at the time, a little reply thing that you could get and cash in for a U.S. postal certificate. I don't think they have them anymore, but that was how he told people he was going to make the money. And so he ended up bringing in 1,000 people, became a hero, an enormous house, a $12,000 car. This was in 1920 in Boston. He ended up going to jail for that, but not before he came to Florida and did a RAND scheme in Florida, and he got incarcerated for that for a year, which he had to serve that time before he went back to Boston. He died in Rio de Janeiro in a pauper's nursing home. But before he died, he wrote a book, his autobiography, called The Rise of Mr. Ponzi, which he tried to sell shares in to people unsuccessfully. And so, you know, you can't blame a guy for trying. You know what I mean? He was trying to sell enough shares in this. Now, I don't know if you can buy this at Amazon. One of the state securities regulators ended up getting the rights to this somehow, and he published it. And so it's really an interesting book. Mark Mathosian published it. But anyway, how do Ponzi schemes work? Well, they can involve anything. I mean, whatever the story is, we have a blinky box to make money. We have some interesting way of doing it. And Craig, don't let me go too far. Interesting way of doing it. And, you know, it's unusual, atypical. But actually all it is, it's like an upside-down pyramid, really. And you start out with a small number of people, and you get it bigger and bigger and bigger. And you're paying off the early investors with money that comes in from later investors. Most of them don't have any real business. The biggest Ponzi scheme I did was in 1994 before I left the SEC, and it was a company in Aventura, Florida, that raised $540 million from people, and they claimed to arbitrage cornflakes, Heinz ketchup, things like that. In other words, they would buy like a truck car load or a train car load of Heinz ketchup in Los Angeles, where they were Heinz was trying to get the market share larger, and they would sell it in Florida and make enormous amounts of money by doing that. Well, what nobody understood was they would probably have to train going as far as from Los Angeles to Florida full of ketchup to account for these returns that they claimed to be making. Well, I told Craig I'd talk a little bit. Most people, you ask them, when do the securities laws, you know, when do they come on the books in the U.S.? Well, that was really 1934, and before that, 1911 with the state security statutes. But the first statutes regulating brokers were in 1285 in London, England. And by 1320, they prosecuted a lot of brokers for being unregistered. And there's really a terrific, I'm not a book salesman, but there's a book called Devil Take the Hindmost. It's really an easy read. You can get it from Amazon. And it's just goes through all the financial frauds up to now. Well, let me tell you how you can recognize a Ponzi scheme. And this is interesting. I just read Warren Buffett's book. And if you read how he got started, I would have thought that was a Ponzi scheme with he and Charlie Munger, who started a partnership out in Los Angeles. But I would have gotten very concerned about that if I was at the SEC. And, of course, he turned out to be a scrupulously honest guy. But most Ponzi schemes start out with paying you a rate of return that's above the market rate of return. Most of them offer you 8%, 15% a month. Some of them, as we've seen with Mr. Madoff, just offers you a return that's slightly more than you could get anywhere else because he's playing to a conservative group of investors. He knew what his audience was and who his investors were. It always involves a surefire scheme. It's profits are guaranteed. Investors are convinced that they're not risking their money in these schemes. Herd instinct. Every Ponzi scheme I've ever seen was sold by word of mouth. And people tell you about it. Your friends tell you about it. You learn about it down by the pool at the condominium. They're all sold word of mouth. They don't advertise them in the Wall Street Journal. They all have an appearance of success, either anecdotal stories, testimonials from people. I've been in this for 10 years. I've been in it for 5 years. They're great guys. You know, but you can always count on them for the returns. I got my money back once when I needed it and put it back in a week later, so I know they're legitimate. Very common thing for people to do. Fear, if you ask too many questions, you'll be thrown out. If you question the promoter's integrity, you will no longer be able to stay in this great money-making investment. Optimism. If you don't believe in the program, things will always work out. And most people always believe in it. People, by human nature, don't want to believe that someone they know will lie to them. There was a guy named Greenman in Miami that claimed to be making an enormous amount of money trading options. And this was back in the early 80s. And we sued him and put him in receivership and his firm in receivership. Well, the reality was there was no option trading business. And what he did, he consistently lost money on. And he just took everybody's previous month balance and multiplied it by one of three or four arbitrary factors to get the next monthly balance. And that's all he did. And he just lived high on the money. People came into my office and said he sat at my table. You know, he was somebody I trusted. You know, I don't know what I'm going to do. I got all my family and friends in it. And that happened over and over again. Well, how can you protect yourself from investment fraud? And I'm kind of speeding along here. First, never send money to a faceless voice over the telephone. You people are all too smart for that. You'd never do that. Beware of high-pressure and low-pressure sales tactics. There was a guy in Naples by the name of Mobley that took in an enormous amount of money in a Ponzi scheme in the 90s after I retired. I interviewed him in jail while he was in jail in Naples for some private litigation. He would tell people, look, I'll only take $1 million. And they'd say, well, I only have $500,000 to invest. Well, sorry, you can't get in this. You can only get in with $1 million. And he told me, he said about 3 or 4 days later, he'd come to work, open his office up, and he had like a little office with some, you know, modest thing that he did just trading in with 2 or 3 people. And under the door would be a check for $1 million. And that's how he got people in, low-pressure sales. Be aware of promises of guaranteed profits. There's no such thing as steady, guaranteed profits, particularly when you're dealing in some kind of investment. Avoid promoters who fail to give you a clear and detailed explanation of the investment or methodology they use for making money. If you can't understand it, don't make the investment. If they tell you they've got a blinky box that's proprietary, don't do it. I sat next to an airline pilot that told me that all the pilots were in a group that was some man that promoted rock concerts, and he was just terrific. And he said, I haven't put my money in there yet, but all the guys I fly with, I'm the co-pilot, all the guys I fly with have their money in there. I said, don't do it. I said, do you get audited financials? No. I said, have you seen the books? No. Do they have a separate account for each rock concert and then you can get your money back? No, you just roll it over. Another hallmark of a securities fraud, rolling those profits over. Just roll it over and we keep on going. And so I said, don't do it. Now, I don't know whether he did it or not. I said, make sure you get those audited financials. Well, the reality was about a year later, the SEC put that guy in receivership, and the books and records were a mess. The whole thing was not making any money, and it was all a fraud. And a lot of airline pilots lost a lot of money. And so they were pretty unhappy about it. Well, I've gone over my time, and I apologize for that. There are some good books out that, if you're interested in this area, in 1841, a book was written about financial frauds, and you can buy it off eBay, and it's about tulip mania, the South Sea bubble, a lot of things like that. It's called Extraordinary Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. So I recommend those books to you. Thank you.
We have one last area about recognizing a Ponzi scheme that Mr. Harper wanted to hear. How many people in here for the last month have heard people and pundits constantly say, how could no one have recognized this? This is too good to be true. How many people have heard too good to be true? It probably isn't. Well, the truth of the matter is that saying is way too simplistic. It's the same saying as you can't read judge a book by its cover or what must up must come down. And in fact, what happens is when too good to be true, for certain people, doesn't hold. For the people on this island, if someone was to say, hey, one day you could live in one of these houses, one day you could be a president of a company, one day you could have success, people would say, well, that's too good to be true. Too good to be true doesn't take into account ingenuity, hard work, and also it doesn't take into account just straight up luck and fortune. And in fact, not only was that what individuals on this island could hold themselves out to be, unfortunately for Mr. Madoff, that was what people would look at Mr. Madoff and say. This was the gentleman who ran the NASDAQ. This was a gentleman who didn't just come out overnight and have a fortune. This was someone through years and years of hard work. And if the Securities and Exchange Commission could not discover that this was too good to be true, there's not a chance that the regular investor with the investing public, frankly, could. Next, we want to discuss other types of financial fraud. And these are a lot more insidious because they're hidden by either market appreciation, meaning that a portion of your funds goes away as the account goes up where it shouldn't have, or depreciation. Well, I'm sorry, the whole market went down. What do you expect? It's not my fault. It's just the general market. The first type, and these are, by the way, these occur in brokerage accounts, trust accounts, and with investment advisors. And you could have multiple independent wrongful acts in different accounts. The major one is sale of recommendation of unsuitable investments. Unsuitable investments. The question becomes, what is suitability? And the idea is, I could give you the example. I love Mazda Miatas, those little red cars. If I went to go buy a Mazda Miata, picked up the car on a Friday, squished myself in there, and look up the salesperson and say, I don't think this car is right for me, could you take it back? He's going to say, no, I don't owe you that responsibility to tell you what kind of car. You should have known when you looked inside the space in the cabin that you wouldn't have fit. However, that's not what a broker or investment advisor owes you. They owe you. They have a responsibility, both statutory and case law, and frankly, in their own regulatory authority and in their own companies, lay out that they have to offer you suitable investments. Number one, it's different for every investor. And it's dependent upon your client objectives. Are you there for income, for principal appreciation, for principal preservation? Two, what are your risk tolerances? Are you okay to lose 10%, 50%? Are you okay to lose everything? And then you match that to the type of investment. A very important part. And I think, frankly, I've seen it on the news too much, and it's just wrong. The comments I've seen in the media are, well, those wealthy people with Madoff, they were sophisticated, they should have known. Frankly, and some that are really upsetting, saying they got what they deserved. That's wrong. I know plenty of college professors that make less than $100,000 a year who are the most sophisticated people I've ever met. I also know people who have hundreds of millions of dollars who, frankly, never finished high school. That does not hold. And you should not let some salesperson or broker say to you, oh, don't worry, you have enough money, this investment is fine for you. That's saying it's okay if you lose your money because you have enough, and it's wrong. Second, while an underlying investment may be suitable, a purchase of IBM or GM stock, if it's in an individual diversified account, that's fine. If it is something called over-concentration, then it's not. And that means they put all your money into one thing. That could be in an individual stock. It could be an individual sector, types of stocks. It could actually be in certain types of equities and debts. And there are ways to protect that called hedging. So if you are, or you're forced to because you work for a company and they gave you the stock, you're not allowed to sell it, you need to speak to your brokers and say, how can I hedge? How can I protect this? And frankly, you should only be doing that if you're forced to do it. If not, you should be diversified. Next, churning. Churning is excessive trading. There's a formula out there. And I apologize, I'm trying to go fast to make up for Charlie's time. churning. There's a formula out there. And what it says is, starting at 2x turnover, if your whole account value has been bought and sold 2x, up to 6x, there is issues or more. There are issues about that there may be churning. Why do brokers churn? For commission, obviously. But there are other reasons, too. Unauthorized trades. First part of it you have to understand is, you are allowed to give brokers time and price discretion. Buy me a stock X and buy it at this price by this date. However, the only other way they can make trades without your authority is if you give them discretionary authority. And I think Charlie could speak to this. Most wirehouses, and I actually do a lot of defense work, Don't let the brokers have discretionary authority, because you have an increased fiduciary duty when you do that. Next, misrepresentations and omissions. Why would a broker make a misrepresentation about a stock? Obviously, number one, commissions. Number two, sometimes it's in good faith reliance upon the brokerage firm. You've seen two examples of that in the past two decades. During the late 80s and 90s, it was limited partnerships. And in the beginning of this year, it was the auction rate securities, where the brokers themselves thought it was liquid. What they didn't realize is, frankly, it was just the brokerage firms trading back and forth between themselves. Further, some brokers have a belief in investment, and they believe in it so much, they will start making up things about it. Not out of a bad intention, but they will, frankly, stretch the truth. Quickly, just other types of annuities. They're very specifically related to certain types of investments. You should be able to ask your broker, why is this annuity good for me? What are the tax benefits? By the way, also annuities pay a very large commission regular to any other type of accounts, and they actually keeps paying commissions over a number of years. Next, sharing profits or selling away. If a broker says to you, don't worry, I'll take some of the loss or I'll take some of the profit, that's a red flag right there. They're not allowed to do that. Selling away. If a broker says to you, hey, I got this great hedge fund, we won't go through the firm. We'll just do it on the side and we'll bring our money to them. That's a red flag. It's illegal and there's issues with that, because by doing that, you don't allow the firm to supervise the accounts. And then the overall catch-all is breach of fiduciary duty. Now, Jack Stein is going to discuss affinity frauds, and then we'll just have a closing comment.
Mr. Mayor, councilmen, members of the community, I've been asked to speak on affinity frauds. Basically, affinity fraud is the use by a seller of securities to gain your trust based upon your personal, financial, or religious connections. He uses those issues to get through to you. It is simply one more tool in the toolbox of the fraudster to separate an investor from their money. It could be any form of scheme, the Ponzi scheme that Charlie talked about, or a bucket shop, or any other operation where someone says or implies to you, because of your relationship, you can absolutely trust us. In 1974, when Charlie and I were both working at the SEC, he took a call from an interesting man, a former prisoner of war from Vietnam, who was troubled about his account. Charlie, because of the complaint, looked into this matter and discovered a case involving a bunch of POWs. These fellows were shot down over North Vietnam. They were in prison for many, many years. Their pay continued to go into trust account. Social Security benefits went into trust account. Some Fort Lauderdale broker wrote to each one of them saying, have you had enough milk yet? Have you had your full of apple pie? As a former prisoner of war, I would like to speak to you about your financial needs, and I understand what they are. Of course, he had never been a prisoner of war, but was fortunate enough as a thief to get several of these people to contact him. After he sold the first three, all the other prisoners of war, not all of them, but a great percentage of them, fell in line, and they invested with him in industrial development revenue bonds, which were absolutely bogus. When asked by Charlie and I at the time, why did they do that? They said, well, all of our buddies did it. They wouldn't do anything wrong. Well, Judge Fulton, when he wrote his opinion, said, in summary, the evidence in his case describes a horrible fraud, one that has been vicious and brutal. It is difficult to imagine how anyone could contrive and execute a more diabolical scheme. It has effectively defrauded and cheated the customers of R.J. Allen, who purchased IDRs, many of whom have been left destitute. That is what you're going to also see on this Madoff matter. You will certainly see that. There's little I can add to that except the statement made yesterday by a member of this community, Fred Adler, to the New York Times, who said, look, I'm an ex-litigator. I can usually smell a crook a mile away. But I didn't get that odor from him, and I'm sure she helped. He was referring to Ruth Madoff, his wife. He's got this pleasant, sweet wife of 30 or 40 years, not some young chick. It somehow added to his credibility. What can you do in these are Jack's rules after 40 years of being familiar with frauds and seeing people coming in after losing their entire life savings. They always come in embarrassed, ashamed, self-deprecating, but ruined. And they come in, and I don't have all the answers. I can't protect you completely. But trust, totally trust, absolutely no one. That means, I didn't say don't invest, but President Reagan had it right when he said, trust but verify. You must look into what you've been told. In that regard, be doubly cautious when investing with someone you know through some association or the like. Again, in the New York Times article yesterday, they cited Kurt Vonnegut, the author, who spoke of something called a Grand Falloon, which was a false association, mistaken for friendship. Two people from the same town, same university, meet somewhere and believe that coincidental connection has significant meaning. It doesn't. No more than belonging to the Palm Beach Country Club or Fifth Avenue Synagogue did to those who used their proximity to Mr. Madoff to coax him into taking advantage of their money. Like your health, you must take care to see who gets control of your money. Invest, my next point would be invest where there will be someone collectible to sue if you are the victim of fraud. As Charlie pointed out, we don't expect anybody in your community to fall for a Nigerian scam or scheme that you find on your computer. Congratulations, you've just inherited $200 million. Just give me your bank information. No, no, this community isn't falling for that. But they will design a scheme tailor-made for you, like your clothes, like Madoff did. He knows no one would go for a 20% a month scheme, so he designed one where he said 10%, 11%, 12%. That was more believable, and because of who he was able to sell it. Next is one thing that I firmly believe on. It's my last point, and I really want you to think on it. No one, but no one, gets all of your investments. I believe you should divide your investments in 2, 3, or 4 ways. If that means you use 2 different brokerage firms, I urge you to do that. I urge you to tell both brokers at both firms the total of the amount you're investing so they'll have a true picture of what you've got. But then they'll know what you got. But you can question each broker at each firm, whether it be Merrill Lynch, Smith Barney, Wachovia, whichever. You can question them about the other investments. You will then become a more sophisticated and educated investor. Very few investors want to read a prospectus. It's just too burdensome. So you have to sort of trust somebody. But the trust you have to place has to be well placed, or you'll be seriously hurt. The wealth that you've accumulated through hard work throughout your whole life, or perhaps have inherited, won't come again. And if one of these people flushes it, as Madoff did, as R.J. Allen did, once gone, it's gone. If you rely on the SEC to protect you, I'm afraid your reliance is misplaced. I have the documents that were sent to the SEC by a so-called whistleblower, a 30-page document which they didn't act on. They opened an investigation and closed it with 2 pages. There are 29 points where he says the world's largest hedge fund is a fraud. That was in the hands of our government who let these investors down. You must rely on yourself. Thank you very much.
I just have one question. Thank you. That particular report you just referred to, what was the date on that report?
05. Yes, it was submitted November 5th, 2005.
Thank you very much.
We just have one quick closing remark, just recommendations. Each individual has different investment objectives and risk tolerances. So here are the questions to ask your financial advisor. Why is this investment suitable for me? How much can I lose? Am I diversified? Are you recommending this to all of your clients? What is your understanding of my objectives? You could say to the broker, I want to make sure I understand. What do you think I'm looking for? And if he tells you something different, you need to correct him immediately. And then look at your opening account documentation. They give you that in the beginning. I guarantee you a lot of you here today will look at the documents, and when you read that it puts down moderate risks, that you could lose a large part of your principal, you'll say, wait a minute, that wasn't my understanding. That's it. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Does anyone have any questions for any of these individuals? I want to thank you very much for coming. I know with everything in the aftermath of Madoff that you've got a lot on your plate and following up for different clients. And, you know, our peace of mind and our safety and security here in this town has a lot to do with our quality of life, and that has a lot to do with our investment security. So I think that it's apropos for you to have presented this today. And if anyone just picked up one point out of your presentation, I think it was worthwhile. But thank you very much for coming.